Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Kia ora, g'day, and welcome to the History of Aotearoa, New Zealand. Episode 131, Sailing Instructions. This podcast is recorded in Te Whanganui a Tara, on the rohe of Mua Upoko, Taranaki Whānui, Te Ati Awa, and Ngāti Toa Rangatira. We are generously supported by our amazing patrons. If you want to support Hans, go to patreon.com/historyaotearoa. Last time, we talked about the lead-up to Abel Tasman's expedition of 1642, which will, spoilers, see him come across the land of the Long White Cloud. Before we get into how that expedition went, today, I want to talk about the instructions that Tasman received from his bosses, the Batavian Council of the Dutch East India Company, and of course, their leader, Governor-General Anthony van Diemen. As we talk about the instructions, it's important to remember that the entire reason the Council wanted this voyage to occur was that they thought there were lots of riches to be had in Terra Australis, the undiscovered continent which was now thought to be in the South Pacific. And if they were the first Europeans to find this land, they would have a head start in exploiting them. It's possible that Tasman and his workmates who helped him set up the voyage, Franz Visscher and Isaac Gillismans, were wanting to explore for the thrill of filling in the blank edges of the map. However, as far as the VOC were concerned, this was a secondary concern to profit and potential trade. In particular, they expected to find gold and silver, like had been found in South America, but presumably they expected to find other useful resources too. In particular, spices, which was the company's bread and butter. That's not to say that Tasman and his officers wouldn't get anything out of this, though. In his instructions from the Batavian Council, they said he would get, quote, certain fruits of gain and undying fame, end quote. Which is rather vague, but was meant to indicate that if they did well, they would get a monetary bonus. So, what are these instructions I keep talking about? Basically, they are the official documents telling Tasman where he should go, what he should be looking for, how he should run his ship, what to do if there is a storm, or if he himself dies, and perhaps most interestingly, what he should do if he encounters non-European humans, among a whole host of other things. Some of it is really boring. Some of it is really insightful, so I thought it would be good to take a look at what the Batavian Council told Tasman to do, because it'll give us a benchmark as to whether the expedition was a success. Or, at the very least, let us understand what the Council's measure of success would be. In the instructions for the voyage, Tasman was basically told to follow the route of the cheaper option in Visscher's memoir that we talked about last episode. That meant he would sail from Batavia in the Dutch East Indies to Mauritius on the east coast of Africa. Then he would sail southeast until he got between 52 to 54 degrees latitude, and then sail straight east until they hit some sort of land, or were at the longitude of the Solomon Islands, whichever came first. If they did come across land, hopefully the Great Southland, then naturally they were told to explore it. If nothing appeared, then they would just sail north and return to Batavia. Although this was the primary route that Tasman was told to travel, he was given a lot of other different options in the instructions, in the event he wasn't able to sail through those waters. Remember, a lot of the stretches of ocean that Tasman and his crew were expected to sail into were totally uncharted. They had almost no idea what to expect. So, just in case things didn't pan out quite the way they hoped, the council wanted to make sure that Tasman knew what other objectives they would find acceptable. As such, Tasman was given freedom to explore the southern coast of Australia if he saw fit. The furthest that the Dutch, or in fact anyone in Europe, had gone along the southern coast was a point called Nui's Archipelago in the Great Australian Bight, about an 8-hour or 770-kilometre drive west from modern Adelaide. As was the practice at the time, it was named after a Dutch guy called Nui, who reached there in 1627. The hope was that if Tasman was able to do this, they would discover if the Cape York Peninsula, that's the pointy bit in the north of Australia near New Guinea, was connected to Niue's archipelago, or whether there was a passage between them that could be utilised. Essentially, they were asking him to find the eastern coast of Australia and chart it. The instructions also said that if he chose to do this, he should explore the northern coast of Australia and the southern coast of New Guinea next to it, to determine if there was a passage between them. At the time, it was unclear if New Guinea and Australia were part of the same landmass or different ones. These objectives were part of a wider goal of the VOC to find out the extent of the Australian continent. Much of the southern and northern coasts hadn't been charted, and the eastern coast hadn't been found at all. So they actually didn't know where the land ended right now. However, for Tasman to do this, he would need to sail north at some point, meaning he would need to abandon his exploration for Terra Australis. And it was generally accepted that trying to find Terra Australis was the better option if there was a choice between exploring more of Australia or exploring further east. This is also because the other objective he was given was to find a route from the Indian Ocean to Chile, which would give them a route that no other European power knew about, something that was of particular import to allow for more trade with that region, and also attacking Spanish interests. Those interests included literally attacking Spanish ships and ports, saying they wanted to, quote, snatch rich booty from the Castilian, who would never dream of our ships coming that way, end quote. But the VOC also wanted to set up gold and silver mines in South America to expand their portfolio. As you might have guessed from the previous Quast expedition having similar goals, the VOC at this time were pretty interested in trying to earn more cash through digging up shiny metal, which is why they added this as a primary plus goal to the 1642 expedition. The reason I call it a primary plus goal instead of a secondary goal like all the Australian stuff is because it wasn't exactly secondary, but it also wasn't necessarily the main goal either. What the company wanted was an easy way to make cash, and expected Tasman to find, quote, fruitful and rich lands, end quote, which they expected would be in the southern hemisphere, since there was that whole balancing the planet idea that meant that whatever land was in the northern hemisphere must have an equivalent in the south. They also pointed to gold and silver being found in Chile and Peru to show that these riches had already been found before, and there was bound to be more. Ideally, these riches would be found in Terra Australis, a brand new continent that no one else knew about or had laid claim to, which would give them a significant head start. But if that didn't pan out, then the precious metal from South America was the next best thing. In saying that, though, they would take any obviously valuable resource, such as gems. So I guess you could say the main goal was to find resources that could make money. The company had some preferred ways that they wanted this to happen, but were happy with whatever they could get. However, setting up mines in Chile did have a slight complication, because by now, the Dutch West India Company had been set up by the States General, and they were given a similar monopoly in the West Indies as the VOC had in the East Indies. At the time, it was unclear if the WIC charter extended into South America, which would mean the VOC weren't allowed to conduct business there of any kind, such as trading posts or mines. The council sought advice from their officers back in Europe, but whatever happened there didn't ultimately matter, as we will see. Overall, regardless of what Tasman decided to do, he needed to be back in Batavia by the end of 1643, about 12 months after he set off. So it was gonna be pretty tight. Given they were sailing into unknown waters and were hoping to encounter lands hitherto unseen by pale eyes, Tasman was expected to gather as much data as he could on any land he came across, as well as the ocean around it. Well, he wasn't expected to do that himself, but the council wanted someone on the voyage to do that. Mostly, this would end up being Gillismans. Specifically, they were to draw and chart, quote, all lands, islands, points, bights, inlets, bays, shoals, banks, sands, rivers, rocks and reefs, etc., which you will meet with, end quote. So, basically everything. They were also tasked with recording their latitude, altitude, the distance from one feature to another, note down any mountains or buildings they found, the depths of the water, the prevailing winds, what the weather was like, how do the river mouths open up, and so on. Basically, anything that could be useful to help others navigate those waters safely. The whole idea was that Tasman was to find out as much as he could about the area and then report that back to Batavia. With that information in hand, the company could send out more ships to set up trading posts to exploit the resources he found, or to trade with the locals to get those resources. So, knowing what kind of hazards were in the water, where the good places to anchor were, and key navigational features like mountains, all presented on some nice maps, was really important if they wanted those future ships to arrive at the right place in one piece. Speaking of locals, as I mentioned earlier, the Batavian Council did give Tasman instructions on what he should do if he encountered non-European humans. As far as I am aware, he wasn't told what to do if he encountered other Europeans, except those in Mauritius along the sailing route, because that was a Dutch base. My guess for this is probably because they didn't expect to meet anyone once they were beyond the edge of the map. Or maybe because conducting himself in a gentlemanly manner was the obvious thing to do, so it didn't bear mentioning. Anyway, the fact they gave instructions for if non-Europeans were encountered at all is something I find quite interesting, because it seems to imply that the council did expect Tasman could meet with people who had never encountered Europeans before. There were those in the Solomons and other Pacific Islands that had already been charted that this could also refer to, since the expedition planned to head in that direction. But it does make me wonder whether at this time it was thought to be pretty normal that there were some people out there in undiscovered lands who were yet to enter the ever-growing global stage. Of course, we now know that there certainly were people like that. Māori, for example. But in 1642, this may have been less obvious. Tasman's instructions on this matter are actually slightly different depending on whether the indigenous peoples he encountered were quote-unquote civilized or not. The council's assumption was that most people the expedition would encounter would be of the non-civilized variety, whatever the fuck that means. And as such, that Tasman should, quote, use great care, because it is apparent the Southlands are peopled with very rough, wild people, for which reason you must always be well armed and carefully on guard, since in all parts of the world it has been found by experience no barbarous people are to be trusted, because they usually think that the people who appear so exceedingly strange and unexpected come only to take over their lands. End quote. And I just find this to be a monumentally baffling statement. Just to reiterate, the Batavian Council are saying Tasman should be careful around indigenous people because they usually think newcomers are there to steal their land. There is so much to unpack out of that. Firstly, that this was clearly coming from a place of experience. The VOC had seen this kind of response to their presence before. Why? Well, that leads me to the second point, that this is very much saying the quiet part out loud. The VOC knew that there was likely going to be trouble because they had actually stolen indigenous land in the past in Indonesia, and they had gotten a very hostile response from the locals, because of course you fucking would. We even mentioned a couple episodes back how even Tasman himself was part of the VOC's colonization efforts in the region. Which leads me to my final point of why this statement is fucking insane. Stealing indigenous land is exactly what Tasman was instructed to do on this expedition. Don't take my word for it, though. Here is a quote from the postscript of the very same instructions that we have been discussing and I have been quoting throughout this episode. Quote, "Take in possession for the high and mighty Lords States General as sovereign of the United Provinces, uninhabited lands, all which have no lord, can be secured by the setting up of a stone as memorial, or the planting of our prince flag for true possession, since such lands rightly belong to the finder and taker." End quote. It goes on to say, quote, "In populated lands, the consent of the people or king shall be necessary in the taking of occupation, which is to be fittingly achieved by amicable influence with the presenting of a small tree planted in a little earth, the joint setting up of a stone, or the planting of the prince flag in memory of their voluntary submission or subjection. All which you should completely record in your journal with naming of the persons who shall be present, so as to be able in future times to serve our republic." End quote. Now, on the face of it, this doesn't seem like he is being asked to steal land from local people. But I would like to remind you that European ideas of monarchs, land ownership, and other such concepts didn't neatly map to non-Western cultures like Māori. It would be very easy to claim that a land didn't have a king or that the people were savages and therefore had no rights to their land. It is something that had happened before and would happen in the future. In addition, Tasman was told he should record all of these interactions into his journal so that the company could then understand what land they now had claim to, which would help them if other European powers, or even the indigenous peoples themselves, tried to dispute that claim. So, I feel quite comfortable saying that Tasman was being given, at the very least, tacit permission to claim whatever land he found, regardless of who was there already. Again, most of this information was aimed at those that they deemed quote-unquote barbarous, and Tasman was given different instructions if he found people who were determined to be more civilized in nature. In fact, he was told, quote, take more account of them than the wild savages, end quote. Though it's not mentioned how he should make this distinction. Much like the physical features of the landscape, Tasman was told to document the people. Quote, what fruits and livestock be there, what sort of structure of houses, the form and appearance of the inhabitants, their clothing, weapons, customs, manner, food, livelihood, religion, government, war, and other notable things, particularly whether they are good or ill-natured, end quote. He was also instructed to note down, quote, what circumstances they and their lands are, and whether anything useful is to be got or done there, end quote. It is reasonably obvious what the VOC wanted this information for. Knowledge is power, after all. That is to say, the company would know if the land had any value for its resources or potential agriculture. And if they could learn about the culture of a people, then they could find ways to exploit that culture during diplomacy or trade to ensure the VOC got the best deal. Or, if worst came to worst, then they would know their military capabilities. To find out what kind of goods a group of people might have, Tasman was told to, quote, inform them you come there to trade, duly observing what they esteem and to what goods they are most attracted, particularly finding out what wares are among them, likewise about gold and silver, and if it is in valued regard by them, representing yourself to be not too eager for it, in order to keep them unaware of the value of the same. End quote. To translate that a little, Tasman was instructed to find out whether any people he came across had anything valuable, like gold, silver, jewels, or spices. He was to do this by just presenting himself as a humble trader, and showing them some of what he had been given to trade, and make some small deals with them. Some items that Tasman was given for this were mirrors, sandalwood, wax, pewter, iron pots, needles, metal tools, cutlery, and even elephant ivory. Doing a little bartering would allow Tasman to find out what sort of stuff they had that the Dutch might be able to profit from, and also what the locals might want in return for that. Plus, Tasman was told not to look too excited if they brought out something really valuable, like a big old chunk of gold, so that the indigenous peoples wouldn't know the true worth of what they had, to allow the Dutch to lowball them later. In addition to all of this, Tasman was told to keep himself in their good graces. All of that work wouldn't mean anything if they thought he was a dick, because the next time the Dutch turn up, all they'll be thinking about is what a massive asshole the last guy was. As such, he was to ignore any petty thievery or other small crimes that the locals might do to him, so as to keep the relationship good. Likewise, he was told to keep his own men in line and not let them do any harm. If it's not already super obvious, let me just spell it out here. This is super fucking insidious. Moving on to more of the internal crew logistics, the instructions of the 1642 expedition detailed that Tasman was to be given 110 men on two ships, along with how much food he was being given and what the daily ration should be. As we mentioned at the start of the episode, it also promised in rather vague terms that they would be rewarded if they found quote-unquote profitable lands. Of the 110 men, about two-thirds of them were experienced sailors, who did the complex job of operating the ship at the orders of the skippers. The other third, about 36 men or so, were soldiers. They would do the menial tasks that didn't require knowing all the different knots or climbing the rigging, because their main job was to keep the crew in line and put down any mutinies if they occurred, which I thought was kind of interesting. Soldiers would be helpful if Tasman encountered any hostilities from indigenous locals or other European ships, but this wasn't a military expedition. He wasn't really expected to be fighting anyone, hence why he was only given a small complement of cannons, and that the soldiers were more there to ensure that the Batavian Council's chosen leader remained in his position. It should also be noted that it was standard procedure for VOC ships to have about one-third of their crew be soldiers, so this setup wasn't terribly unusual. Another interesting tidbit about the crew is that although it's kinda instinctive to imagine all of them were Dutch, given they were employed by a Dutch company backed by the Dutch state, there actually could have been lots of different nationalities on board. Scandinavians, Germans, French, English, and many more were present in Batavia in the employ of the VOC. So, while the majority of Tasman's crew and officers were likely Dutch, there could have been a few other languages being spoken on deck too. At this point, it's probably worth talking a bit more about the specific ships Tasman was supplied with. The flagship, the one Tasman would sail on and have direct command over, was the Heemskerk, a yacht ship, meaning it had a square stern, 3 masts, square sails, and would have been around 25 to 30 meters long. This type of ship was primarily used for trade, though they were often given a light armament of cannon to defend themselves with. Typically, the Dutch Navy was made up of East Indiamen, another type of ship that was similar to the yacht, but was made of heavier wood, meaning it was sturdier but less manoeuvrable. Given this, and the fact that the yachts were often armed anyway, they became more and more favoured as a military vessel over time. As such, the Heemskerk's most recent service had been in a military capacity fighting the Portuguese, but with a peace treaty having been recently signed between them and the Dutch, this means the Heemskerk could be released for other duties, which is how it ended up being put to use as an exploratory vessel. The other ship that Tasman was given was the Zeehan, a flout. These ships had round sterns and could be between 30 to 40 meters long. Given flouts had ample cargo space, as well as being cheap to build, maintain, and crew, they were used a lot for trade missions, carrying goods like rice, wheat, and pepper from the East Indies to Europe. They would often make this trip twice in their life before being permanently stationed in the East, where they would undertake shorter voyages, usually transporting cargo from a smaller colony and offloading it at a central depot, where a much larger East Indiaman would pick it up and take it back to Europe. The Heemskerk was the larger of the two vessels, carrying 60 men to the Zeehan's 50, as well as having more cargo space to carry their trade goods. In addition to the main ships, they had 2 smaller boats, which were either towed behind or sailed alongside them. They were about 8 meters long and used to carry people or supplies to land or between the bigger ships. There was also a 6-meter cockboat in the middle of each ship that could be powered by oars. Even though I have mentioned the general features of yachts and flouts, there could be a lot of variation from ship to ship, such as the general size, the number of decks, cargo space, armaments, and so on could all be slightly different, even if both ships were technically the same class. However, overall, the VOC tried to standardize how ships were built and maintained, attempting to minimize the amount of complexity in their logistics. In terms of food, the specific provisions the crew were supplied with depended on the time of year. During the Northern Hemisphere winter, they tended to have more perishable goods, since they didn't spoil quite as quickly in the cold weather. Naturally, a lot of space in a ship was dedicated to drink, usually beer, water, or arak, an alcoholic drink made from coconut flowers or sugarcane. Some attempts were made to try and make a still that could be kept in a ship's hold to get salt out of seawater. This was a pretty good idea, because it meant that ships would have unlimited water on long voyages. At the moment, they only had whatever drink was stored on board, which meant that they needed to be frequently resupplied. Naturally, this was all the more dangerous when you were going into unknown waters with no known outposts to take on more drink, and no knowledge of where fresh water might be. So, this still would solve a pretty major problem, but it took up too much space that could be used for more important stuff, to say nothing of the fact that they needed to have a fire burnt under them to actually work, which wasn't super good on a wooden ship. Since ships needed to come into a port for more supplies fairly often, on long voyages there would be refreshment stations along popular trade routes, such as down the west coast and around the southern tip of Africa. These stations usually had veggie gardens, orchards, and grazing animals, with small communities dedicated to serving these ships as they passed on their journeys. Interestingly, it was generally more favoured to fully stock a ship with supplies, so that it didn't need to make any stops, since crews had a higher chance of survival if they didn't make land until their destination in the east. The reason for this was that sometimes these stations had something or other bad about them. Hostile indigenous peoples, undrinkable water supplies, the crew could catch a disease, or even possibly desert. For Tasman specifically, on his 1642 voyage, he allowed for 2 meals a day, breakfast and lunch. Breakfast would consist of porridge, dried prunes with biscuit, which was maybe like hardtack, and some butter. Lunch would be peas with fish, bacon, or some other meat. There may also have been some cheese and vinegar too. Every sailor was also allowed a ration of alcohol each week, as well as water. Though the water was perhaps less than preferable, because sometimes it was rather rank. Quote, "The water often had to be sucked through clenched teeth to prevent the entrance of crawling vermin," end quote. As you might have noticed, none of the foods I mentioned contain a lot of vitamin C, and so scurvy would often become a problem a few months into a journey. However, it was hard to avoid, since they couldn't take perishable foods with them, because they would, well, perish. It's pretty obvious that the VOC not only knew about this problem, but actually tried to rectify it through the orchards and veggie gardens at the refreshment stations, as well as the introduction of scurvy grass onto ships. However, it's likely they didn't know the specific thing that was causing the disease, given that even by Cook's time, over 100 years later, the problem still hadn't been fully solved. After the logistical statements, the instructions added the more formal stuff of proclaiming Tasman as the leader of the expedition, and that he was allowed to fly the Dutch flag, which was often done to alert the ship's council to meet, since the officers were spread over two ships. Now, this is different to the Batavian Council, who managed the affairs of the Dutch East Indies. This was a council just for the leadership of this expedition. Ships' councils were common on Dutch ships, and in fact, pretty much all ships, regardless of nationality at this time. The officers on board ships were often experienced sailors, some of them having sailed for decades, each with a wealth of knowledge and experience on subjects like navigation, seamanship, or the capabilities of the ships themselves and their crews. There were also those that had a lot of theoretical knowledge from years of study, less practical experience, but their advice was valuable in a different way. With all of this accumulated wisdom at their disposal, it was expected, and generally just a good idea, for captains to consult their officers on various important matters to get their advice on how to proceed, particularly in dangerous situations that they were unsure of, and even more especially when they were in unknown waters where there was virtually no hope of rescue. This could be easier said than done, though, because sometimes the important officers were split across multiple ships, as was the case in this expedition. Tasman made frequent use of ships' councils, partially because he was required to, but also because he had hand-picked a lot of his officers, and they had sailed together numerous times, so he likely trusted their opinions. At the end of the day, though, Tasman was the commander, and so he had the final say. Well, usually, but we'll get to that in a second. In this same section, they explain that the officers and crew should respect and obey their leader. After this, they list the specific officers on board and their roles. In terms of our main trio, the newly minted Commander Tasman was declared the permanent president of the voyage, Visscher as the pilot major, which is the chief navigator, and Gillismans as the merchant on one of the ships, which meant he was responsible for keeping track of their trade goods and using them to make good deals when the time came. The instructions also listed the names of the skipper of each ship, the secretary, and the upper mate. They go on to say that these people make up the council, and that all major decisions should go through a vote of this council. In the event that there was a tie, Tasman would get two votes to break it. However, this depended on the scenario. If the vote was regarding a matter of justice to punish a crew member for a crime, the two bosuns would also get a vote each. If the matter related to navigation, then Visscher, as pilot major, got the extra vote instead of Tasman. And the instructions stressed that in these cases, Visscher's advice should be, quote, taken in proper regard, this voyage being planned with his communication, end quote. In other words, Tasman should take extra heed of Visscher's advice in matters of navigation, because he knows what he is doing, and he had in fact been one of the people to plan the route in the first place. The navigator on a ship was an extremely important role. They were the ones to make sure you got to where you were going and then got back home without getting lost in the infinite ocean. Often, they were very experienced and well-respected, Visscher being no exception. As we have discussed before, he was highly regarded throughout the Dutch East Indies. So, it isn't too surprising that his word, in some cases, held more weight. Tasman was also instructed to seek advice from non-council officers, even if they didn't get a vote. The instructions also said that as soon as he was out to sea, Tasman and his council should figure out what they should do if the two ships get separated, and to decide how he wanted to communicate between the ships, recording that process in a signal document. Basically, the Batavian Council wanted to ensure every base was covered, at least as much as they could, since if it all went tits up, then it was their money down the drain. As part of this, they lay out the line of succession should Tasman die. If that were to happen, quote, which God forbid, end quote, the skipper of the flagship would assume command. The instructions then finish with a bit of a prayer or blessing to God to give them courage, protect them, and all that stuff. It is then signed by Van Diemen and other members of the Batavian Council before the postscript we already talked about. With the plan laid out and the route set, on the 12th of August 1642, the two ships Heemskerk and Zeehan set out on their adventure to find new lands full of riches and exotic people with strange customs. For adventure! For glory! For empire! Only for the Zeehan to immediately run aground. Shit. If you want to get in touch, my email and social media are on historyaltearoa.com. Aotearoa spelt A-O-T-E-A-R-O-A. You can also find helpful resources there, like transcripts and sources. If you would like to support Hans, you can do so through donating via Patreon or giving us a review. As always, haere tū atu, hoki tū mai. See you next time.